You're listening to the Laugh Factory Podcast Network. For more shows, visit the podcast page at laughfactory.com.
It's the After Laugh, After Laugh. Welcome to the After Laugh, After Laugh, After Laugh. After Laugh, man.
Of course.
Go ahead and pull up a chair.
Yeah, we are on. Hey guys, welcome to the After Laugh. I'm here with my friend Jimmy Shin, the hardest working man in show business. I mean, you kind of are. It's always amazing. Every time I look at my feed to get, you know, because I want to get my daily dose of FOMO. I always feel like you have so many shows that you're on, you're producing, and you're hustling. You got some sort of special sauce, man. I don't know if it's work ethic or likability or talent or whatever, but you definitely have honed in on how to create really and curate very cool, awesome shows. And you're a funny guy and a nice guy. Can you not get in the apartment, weirdo? Okay. See, look, ruining everything. Anyway, I don't really know. We haven't really hung out before. I've done your shows before. Always thought you were a super cool guy, but I don't really know your story much.
Yeah.
So I'm always curious to know when you got started and all that jazz. Let's let people hear the beginning.
Well, I started the journey actually in law school, and I went to law school because my parents made me. And they're Asian. They're traditional.
Chinese?
Korean.
Korean, okay.
Yeah. I almost said Asian, but that was obvious. But yeah, so when I was a kid, man, my dad had a vision board on the wall.
Whoa.
And it said, Jimmy Shin, attorney at law.
That's
and
amazing.
So, yeah, I would look at that thing and I'd be like, one of these days I'm going to be a lawyer.
When you were a kid, like how old?
Probably like 12 years old.
12 years old.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's still up on my wall. Now I like to go laugh at it. But I'm all for vision boards. It just has to be your vision board.
Of course.
Right?
Yes.
And so he was smart, man. He knew how to sort of brainwash me and convince me that I wanted to be an attorney.
Isn't that what parents do? They brainwash you.
Yeah. Yeah, mine did.
Yeah.
For sure.
I think about that with the religion. Like, I don't know why I stand with the religion now, but my parents, like early on, my dad was like a born-again Christian.
Okay.
They're chasing Lindsay Lohan right now, whatever the fuck they're doing. Everyone's wearing these helicopters. So for the longest time, I was just like, yeah, man, I'm a super devout Christian, and I believe this. And then you get into college, you start smoking weed, maybe you do mushrooms and peyote. You're like, okay, hold on, let me just think about this a little bit more. But I think brainwashing is kind of a good thing, right?
Yeah.
Because obviously,
when did you break out of the whole Christian thing?
I don't know if here's the thing. I don't know if I can ever really break out of it, because it wasn't like my parents brainwashed me and I escaped like the Mormonism religion. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh my God, I'm a free man. Like my parents are great. So it wasn't like I was escaping these chains of ideology, but I just started kind of going like, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know how I feel about what I'm seeing. You know, you're in high school. I think you start going like, you go to church. I don't know how you grew up. I go to church. You just see these people, and they're all wearing slacks.
Yeah,
and they have no asses, and they just look.
So you went to a white church,
obviously. And they would try to do like rock songs, like Christian rock songs. That they would take like a contemporary pop song, and they would try to adapt it with. Hold on one second. It was obviously very white, and suburban Virginia. And it was kind of like, I feel like it was like the birth of the soccer mom, that whole area. And a lot of perfume. You know what I mean? There's something about when you're a kid and you're in high school and everything is just sort of like, I think you have a real good antenna for what's authentic when you're younger. That gets clouded, and particularly when we move to places like LA.
Yeah.
You know? And you just know that something's a little off here.
Yeah.
Not that they were keeping a Jew in their basement, but just something that there was a little bit of a life that wasn't the life that was being promulgated and preached about on these Sundays.
Well, we noticed the hypocrisy of it all. You know, you go home and they're preaching one thing and then you see another, as far as my parents, they were very argumentative.
Oh, really? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they, you know, didn't live it perfectly for sure.
Yeah.
And then they would tell me to do something, but they would do the opposite. You know what
so
I mean?
So your parents, were they both very strict? Or was like one
They were very strict, yeah.
Yeah. Would you say you had a tiger mom? Was that kind of your...
I had a tiger mom and a tiger dad.
Yeah,
know?
That's
so I had
usually...
like the best of both worlds. And so...
And brothers and sisters?
No brothers and sisters.
Oh,
so,
man.
Yeah.
So it was all about yeah. you, attorney.
Yeah,
attorney
at law.
Attorney
I was
at
the
law.
Last one that was going to, you know, continue
oh
the
God.
Shin
that's
legacy.
That's a lot of pressure, man.
That's a lot of pressure, buddy. That's why I started doing drugs.
Were your parents... of course. Were your parents, were they born in Korea and came here?
They were born in Korea and immigrated here.
Oh
yeah.
Wow! So first, it was like that Aziz Ansari movie, you know,
yeah.
a movie, the series,
yeah,
Master of None, where like these immigrant parents, they've worked their asses off to get to America to give their sons opportunity. And their kids are like, it's tough. So I can't imagine that because my mom was like a community college dropout, and my dad was, you know, he was a bureaucrat, a government worker. We were never wealthy. And I think my parents were just kind of like, I hope my kids get to go to college one day. That was basically where their aspiration ended.
Yeah.
Hope they get to go to
college.
Were
they happy that you became a comedian?
It's a long story. Basically, like, they were basically, if you guys go to college, and my dad was very frugal. We didn't really get to do a lot of shit growing up. You know, I had the Atari 2600 up through fucking, like, you know, high school. Everyone else is like on PlayStation or whatever the fuck it is. But he saved. He saved. And he said, if you guys go to college, I'll pay for your first 2 years of college if you get into college. So my first brother went to Cornell. My second brother went to Penn. I went to Princeton.
Nice.
So my parents were fucked. They could never do anything again because they made that promise.
Yeah.
So, I don't know why I said that, other than the fact that like they didn't have a lot of expectations, and we kind of exceeded their expectations in a lot of ways.
Wow!
Because my two older brothers were both brilliant, like crazy brilliant people. Like when Good Will Hunting came out, I called my brother and I was like, Jim, there's a movie about you.
Wow!
Because he was a delinquent, get arrested for shit and get in fights, and
but he was super smart.
But he was a genius. He got perfect score in his SATs. So And I was definitely like the black sheep. So I think by the time that I became a comedian, I think my parents had sort of opened their eyes to the fact that the world is bigger than a monolithic view, the myopic view they had of the world is like, just do your thing. And they started realizing, oh, like this brother's marrying a Muslim. This one has a black girlfriend. This is in a marriage that's a difficult marriage. Like he sort of, he's exactly, my dad's the exact person to be manipulated by the worst part of Republican propaganda and ideology. You know what I mean? Because he's just a good man. And he believes in God and the government and all that shit. And he'll listen to the FDA if they have, you know, advice on what to eat and what to do. Oh, yeah, the food pyramid. Yeah, the four food groups. And you realize all of it's a bullshit now. The pyramid's completely fucked and wrong. They've still never changed it. So, but he's like just a good guy who just believes in all the stuff unironically.
Yeah.
Which is very weird. So for your parents, were they attorneys?
No. I think it might have been my dad's dream because he just pushed it on me so much that, you know, I want you to be a lawyer. And I think to them it meant power, right? To have a son that was an attorney, it meant power in this sort of new world that they had immigrated to.
What was he doing before? Like, when did they immigrate here?
They immigrated when I was 4 years old. And
okay.
So about 40 years.
40 ago. Years. So your parents were in their 20s probably, huh?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, 20s. Maybe my dad was in his 30s,
In his 30s. But he wasn't before they moved here. He was doing what?
Before he moved here, I think he might have been a gangster.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
That's fucking awesome.
Kind of
awesome.
A gangster because he was I know he was an alcoholic.
Oh, shit.
Exactly. Yeah. He wanted me to get him off.
Get him out of jail.
The neighbor just said that's why he wanted me to be a lawyer.
So you really think he was a gangster?
Yeah. Yeah, because he has tattoos.
Oh, like shit. I know. I see.
And he has like almost like, you know, ones that are like prison tats.
Oh.
But in his generation, you were like either the Yakuza or you were very square, you know, suit wearing, you know, professional.
Yeah.
You know? And so for him to have tattoos, I mean, he's never going to tell me that that's what he did. You
really,
know what I mean?
He's never going to put like, Dad, let's just sit down. We're adults now. Let's have a beer. Let's
but he's told me some stories of him, you know, fucking people up and
really
you know, doing shit. Yeah, yeah. Like, he's told me some stories.
Like as an enforcer, as just like bar fights or what?
I think he was trying to teach me how to fight. You know, as a kid, and then, he, you know, as a kid, I also had like a boxing bag set up, and he made me punch it with my bare hands. He just wanted me to toughen me up.
Yeah.
And he just knew, you know, sort of the streets, and he would teach me how to fight and teach me like little tricks of how to knock people out and like get them in the neck and, you know, trip them over and just, you know. Dirty tricks that I'm like, wow.
Yeah, how did you feel about that when you're a kid?
When I was a kid, I was just like, why do I need to know these sort of crazy things to fuck people up?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But it, you know, I ended up using it.
Someday. Really?
So yeah, some of it.
In school or like later?
Yeah, man. I had a bad temper when I was a kid.
Mm.
You know, I kind of grew out of it a little. But yeah, I used to get in a lot of fights as a kid. You know, just one thing would just pop me off and I would just go right for the punch. You know what I mean?
So you're kind of known as like a tough kid in high school?
I don't know about that. But I just had a bad temper. You know, I don't know if I was known as the tough kid or not, but people didn't really fuck with me that much.
Yeah.
But no, I just had a bad temper.
Like some
would
go
and I would just, you know, go right to punching, you know.
And where did you grow up? What school?
In Tacoma, Washington.
Oh, Tacoma, Washington. Okay, got it. Yeah.
Yeah, but so, you know, little clues of stories he would tell of fucking people up and doing this. And I'm like, this doesn't sound like you were a lawyer. You know what I mean? It doesn't sound like you were an engineer. You know? So
you grew up in this household like a pressure cooker
for
all this stuff. Your dad wants you to fulfill all of his dreams.
Yeah.
Maybe his failed aspirations.
Yeah. And his idea of discipline, and he would make me study, made me study Korean and whatnot. But he had a stick on one side. It said discipline and the other side it said love. And he would hit me in the hands with it like to discipline me. Right.
Yeah.
But of course, that type of abuse leads to rebellion.
Isn't that wild?
And, yeah.
It's so interesting because, you know, having a daughter myself, I kind of go, there's that weird fine line and you don't know which side is the side to err on because there are people who grow up with discipline and they end up like becoming the most successful people in whatever it is they do.
Yeah.
I mean, look at the most successful athletes in the world. It wasn't because their parents were like, hey, if you want to play golf, go ahead.
Yeah.
They, like, look at Serena Williams' dad and King Richard. They were a little bit abusive.
Yeah.
Jackie Chan grew up being abused in the Peking Opera. So there's something about it.
But do they end up being happy?
Maybe they do eventually. Maybe I think there's a point where they just can't. They're not. I think in any discipline, and maybe the same thing with comedy as well, there's a point where you're slogging through it.
Yeah.
Because you're trying to find who you are, your voice, you hate it, you hate your material, you hate the fuck, you hate everything.
Yeah.
And then you have to like keep navigating past it. So I think that that's a tricky question because sometimes people, they end up on the other side of it and they are happy and sometimes they end up never succeeding what they want and they're miserable and then you probably meet in the AA program. You know what I mean?
Well, for me, the grave unhappiness led me to find stand-up because I was on this track to becoming a lawyer.
So you actually went to law school?
I went to law school. I actually have a JD.
Oh, wow.
It's California Western School of Law down in San Diego.
And the JD is like, is that 4 years?
It's a Juris Doctorate. It's a three-year program.
Okay. Yeah.
I took about four.
4 years,
because I was partying. And I was also selling weed in large amounts. I was selling pounds and pounds.
So you're like a mini cartel.
I wouldn't say cartel, but I was getting a lot. I was getting it from Seattle, and back then they didn't have like it was illegal.
Yeah.
So you bring some stuff from, you know, BC or Seattle, you know, you're going to flip it for probably three times the amount.
So the weed was being grown in British Columbia or Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't really being grown in California at this point.
No. Well, some was in Humboldt County and stuff like that.
Yeah. You know what I mean? The real expansive farms were in like, interesting.
Yeah, because it was illegal.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so just recently in the last, five, six, seven years.
It's wild to think about.
Yeah.
So you were in law school selling weed.
Selling weed. And then one day I got busted.
So let's backtrack a little bit. So you're feeling all this pressure and you see your parents kind of in maybe a little bit of a toxic relationship, may I say.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
And are you soldiering through it? Are you putting blinders on, going like, hey, man, if I get out of here, I'll get my law degree. This is the goal. I'll escape.
That was
this.
My way out. Yeah. That was my way out is through education because I was smart in school.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was the track that I was on. You know, there was no getting off
track. You didn't think about other options at that point in high school.
So I feel like the universe, through drugs and alcohol and through the drug bust, took me off that track.
Yes.
And while I was on probation, I found stand-up comedy. I was like, what do I have to lose?
Yeah.
And I always wanted to try this shit. I fucking am a loser.
Yeah.
I got busted. My parents hate me. They're ashamed of me.
Wow.
I brought shame to our family. Like, what do I have to lose?
Yeah, yeah.
Because before that, I was always afraid.
Yeah.
You know, you ever want something so bad that you don't even want to try it because you don't want to be bad at it?
Yeah. Or
that's what I was afraid of. Yeah. It was protected because I wanted to do it.
So
you know what I mean?
When did you know that you wanted stand-up to be part of your life? Did you grow up watching specials and stand-up and comedy?
Yeah, yeah. I just was never taught. You know, we're a product of what we're taught, right? And our conditioning and society. And, you know, we're given, each of us are given individual scripts of how our life should look like.
100%.
You know? And finally, I had to come to a point where I had to think outside of the script.
Yeah.
And go, do I keep following the script that was given to me to become a lawyer, or do I find my own script, write my own movie, and be happy?
Of course. So let me, because, so on one level, here you are, you're following the thing, following the program, you get into, before JD, there's undergrad, right?
Yes.
And that was just a degree in?
It was in pre-law? Communications.
Communications, okay. So that's a party degree, right?
Yeah, 100%. They don't even have the... I was in PR.
So when you got into, when you're in college and you're on your own for the first time, right, I'm assuming, was like, holy shit, I can create my own fucking world.
Yeah.
I can do whatever the fuck I want.
Yeah.
So is that when the tattoos started? Did you start kind of, did you instantly start going rebelling once you got into college?
Yeah, I was always rebelling.
Okay.
Probably since I was 12 years old when I started drinking.
Interesting.
I started doing coke.
And you hid that from your parents.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Did they ever catch you?
A couple times, you know. And I
where'd
got
they catch
big,
you with?
Big, they caught me with weed before. Mm-hmm. They caught me with, that's about it, weed and alcohol.
And what would they when they caught you, what would they tell you in terms of anything prophylactically to kind of stop you from doing it? Did they have like, hey, listen, we love you, this is going to damage your brain? Or was it just like...
No. No, I'd get a whooping, you know,
get a whooping.
With the stick. Yeah.
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 And no explanation why.
Well, I you know, to me, that was because I did something wrong. Because I knew that I shouldn't be doing drugs and alcohol.
But they didn't tell you why or anything. It was just like,
well, I didn't really need to know why because I knew why.
Yeah.
I got caught. I got caught with my hand in the cookie jar.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So to speak.
But they don't, they didn't know how to express to you that they love you. So they need you to kind of, they want you to be.
Yeah, it was more like, man, it's old school, man. You spare the rod, you spoil the child.
100%.
And I know what's best for you.
Yes.
And if you do what I say, your life will be great.
Out. Yeah.
But if you don't, you will become a loser.
You'll be
and
a drug addict. You'll be homeless and drug addict.
And a homeless drug addict. And if you pursue entertainment, you will also be a homeless drug addict.
And not a bad argument, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
For some people.
Yeah,
so
for some people.
So you're out rebellious in college. You start doing selling the weed in college, or once you get your JD.
I was selling weed way before that. I was selling drugs since I was like 16.
Wow! So you were always a hustler.
Yeah, yeah. I was always a hustler.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah, so it was like frog in boiling water. You were kind of like.
And during college, I promoted clubs, nightclubs.
Yeah.
You know, I had like a production company with people flyering it up on cars, and we'd stand out, and it was all fun.
Yeah,
you know,
it was
fun. Just to meet chicks.
Yeah.
You know?
Isn't that why we do most of the stuff in our life?
Oh, yeah. That's what I loved about stand-up comedy, too. You were up there, and then, chuckle fuckers, would come talk to you.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
And so I just love the power of that. I love the power of having the drugs, too.
Yeah.
That gets you chicks as well.
Yeah. Particularly cocaine.
Yeah, yeah. Particularly cocaine. It's the unfair advantage we've always wanted, right?
So you're getting – you got busted while you're getting your JD with – selling weed or coke?
I got busted selling weed.
Okay, so what year is your last year as you get your JD or you're getting your...
Yeah, it was my last year, and they let me actually graduate.
Yeah.
But they made sure that I was going to rehab and, you know.
So you got busted by the school police?
Yeah. No. I was got busted by DEA.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, and it was in the newspaper.
Wow.
San Diego Tribune, like, this guy gets caught with fucking pounds of weed and thousands of dollars and Jimmy Shin, you know.
Yeah.
And my fucking school started finding out.
Oh, Jesus.
And then the dean invited me in, and basically, at first, she wanted to know if I was gay. And that's
what?
Why I was, you know, she knew I was living an authentic life. And I had platinum hair back then, too. And I had, like, fucking... I was like the Dennis Rodman of law school.
Oh, my God.
You know, I was clearly living rebelliously because I wasn't happy. And I was trying to express myself because I didn't have a true outlet for what was the fire inside of me. You know what I mean? Had to go somewhere.
Yeah.
And so it came in the form of, you know, drug dealing. It came in the form of partying all the time, coloring my hair.
I
was like a rebellious teenager. You know what I mean?
Were you still fighting?
Not really. At this point, man, I'd mellowed out pretty much, and I was always more of a talker than
a fighter.
You were
a popular kid.
Yeah. People liked me. I didn't.
Yeah.
I got along with people.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I didn't need to get in fights.
So how
I talked my way out of fights.
How deep? Because the fact that the DEA got involved, I mean, they were starting like a whole. There was a board with faces on it and fucking pins and shit.
Yeah, maybe.
How far down the rabbit hole did it go? Was it just like, had they been like following you for like weeks before they busted you?
I don't know. But how they busted me, since you asked, is I would mail packages of money, like thousands of dollars. And I told my guy, I don't want to mail money. You know what I mean? It's just too risky. What if you don't get the package? And then I'm saying I sent it and you didn't receive it. You know what I mean?
Of course.
So I didn't want to send the money. But he goes, just fucking send it.
Yeah.
And he pretty much hung up on me.
Yeah.
Because I guess he just, that's the way he operates, right?
Yeah.
That's his modus operandi.
Yeah.
And so one day I get a knock on the door and they confiscated a package from a UPS place. I think dogs came and sniffed it out because the money smelled like weed.
Oh, wow.
So they thought weed was in there, not money.
Yeah.
Because I put the money and the weed in the same fucking safe, which you should never do.
Listen,
all those
kids.
Aspiring drug dealers out there. So, you know, I just made stupid mistakes, was very reckless, thought I was invincible. I talked my way out of everything my entire life.
Sure.
And finally, you know, it was the cookie crumbled.
So when they knocked on the door, because of course I'm writing the movie in my head, right?
Yeah.
Was it just like the one
bald-headed
cop?
It was
with
like
a badge?
A fucking movie.
How many people were in? Were the
seven
guns drawn?
Seven agents, guns drawn.
Whoa!
I was pinned in my kitchen, on the floor,
knee
handcuffed,
in the neck.
So tight that I had like little welts on my hand.
Yeah.
And they treated me like it was an episode of Cops.
Buddy. So wait, so they busted in, or they knocked and let you in? It's like, freeze.
They kind of busted in, bro.
They kind of busted in.
And I knew my rights, and I kept saying that. I go, I know my rights. I'm a fucking you know,
they had a warrant,
I'm in law
though,
school.
I'm assuming.
They
right?
didn't have a fucking warrant, brother.
What?
No.
That seems highly illegal.
That's the way they operate, brother.
Yeah.
They figure they're going to, it's my,
yeah,
it's
like
my word against theirs.
Yeah, of course.
Are they going to believe the drug dealer or the DEA?
Yeah. 70
I hate to say it, but
ages.
That's the kind
of
shit that goes down, and
of
that's
course,
what
man.
Black Lives Matter is all about.
Of course.
You know that, right?
100%.
Because they're not following protocol.
100%.
They're busting indoors, brother, and planning evidence. And, you know, not everyone. I don't want people to get the wrong impression. I'm pro-police. But there is a lot of corruption going on.
Of course.
And a lot of fucked up shit that happens to particularly black people.
Yeah.
But
and they also,
to everybody.
Yeah.
You know
sometimes,
what I mean?
And also sometimes it's sort of like what was going on with the mafia in the 80s in New York with Giuliani and stuff. Like they knew it was going on.
Yeah.
But they knew that the burden of proof was so high
and
the corroboration access was so huge that they were like, we got to fucking frame them because that's the only way we can make it stick.
Buddy. If they want to bust you, they'll do anything.
But usually it's kind of my feel, because my brother's a cop. You know, I say in my act, like my dad's Trump supporter, my brother's a cop, my mom's name is Karen, it's a honky hat trick. But it's true, my brother's a cop, and, you know, I'm very sympathetic to my brother, and he's a very, very smart guy. He was one of the two genius brothers. And he, from his point of view, as someone who, you know, if he is racist, I don't hear about it. It's something that is internal in him. But his point of view is that, like, most cops are really just trying to figure it out.
Yeah.
Because the system is actually,
and I believe
not,
that. And I want to qualify with what I said.
Yeah.
With you know, there are also good cops that are just trying to figure it out and do the right fucking thing.
One or two bad cops fucks it up for everybody.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. Yeah.
But there are people, and if you're big enough and they want to bust you,
100%.
You know what I mean?
I mean, even with you know, Mar-a-Lago and Trump and all that stuff, like, you'll find a way.
Yeah.
You'll find a way, make it work.
Yeah.
And that, you know, I'm of a mixed mind. I don't know if you heard about, what's his face? Sam Harris talked about the warrant on Mar-a-Lago. And look, I'm not a Trump supporter. I don't, you know, I think he's a fucking idiot. But like, he was like, look, Democrats think he is so dangerous that of course they're going to suppress the Hunter Biden bad. Of course, they're going to do anything they can to get this guy out of office.
Yeah.
Which I get, but I'm also like, that's a slippery fucking slope. Because, you know, like, the ends justifies the means. Yes, I get it. You know, if Hitler was around, would you do anything? Would you lie about anything to get him out? Of course you would. And so people are literally feel like he's that dangerous. If that's what you feel, I understand. You will even create a dubious rape allegation and take it to its logical end because you feel like you need to get this guy out. So I get it. It's also,
but he's guilty of some of the stuff.
Of course he is. Of course he is.
100%. There's like a mountain of evidence. Of course he
is. Yeah. But also like not guilty enough to get him completely sequestered in the way that they want him to immediately. I mean, maybe, who knows? Time will tell. But they've been trying for a long time. And believe me, I get it. But it's also like, man, there's a certain point where you're like, ooh, please come up with really good evidence. I don't want to keep hearing all this fucking shit that it's everything's a hoax and everything's a vendetta, because it just makes everyone who, you know, wears a baseball cap with an American flag on it going like, what the hell is going on, man? What are they doing? So it's, I see myself as both sides. You know, I'm always like, I'm half white, half trash. I see myself as like, I have redneck family, I have trailer park family, and I have like Harvard professor family. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I kind of, anyway. So let's get back to your drive. So they came in, a no-knock warrant, I guess is maybe what they did.
Yeah.
And they were, you just fucking shit in your pants?
Yeah.
I mean, that must have been terrifying. Yeah, at this point, like, you had no criminal record, no felony, no misdemeanors, nothing, right?
Yeah.
You're lying there. Are you thinking you're going to jail for life?
It was over.
And you're thinking, my fucking parents,
I finally did it. You know, I finally did something that I'm not going to be able to just talk my way out of.
Yeah.
And I knew I was fucked.
Yeah.
You know?
So they
little did I know, you know, if you want to keep going with the timeline, we can, but we can fast forward a little if you want.
Well, you know, give me the foreplay. I want to get my chubby going.
Okay.
So they frog march you out, put you in the back of the thing.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't explained, they've read you your rights, I'm assuming, at this point. And they take you down to a precinct at this point.
Yeah.
Book you, which is, I've been, you know, arrested and booked before. It's a nerve-wracking fucking process.
Oh, yeah.
And they want to keep you in a state of confusion.
Here's the kicker. I had just done a Molly because I was a DJ back then. I just fucking dropped a Molly that hit me when I went into the... that was the best way to go to jail, kind of, because I loved all my cellmates. But at the same time, it was just like I'm tripping in a fucking jail cell.
Yeah, yeah. Were you with, was it like killers and rapists and murderers? Were you in a cell full of like...
There was actually one guy in there, and he ended up being a fucking undercover cop getting information from me.
Oh, but shit.
I was so high that I couldn't even recognize that. And it was obvious in retrospect. You know what I mean?
Did you tell him shit too?
Not too much shit. Yeah. No. Yeah. No, not too much shit. But I made it seem like, of course, as all drug dealers do, you know, a lot bigger than you are. Like, I try to make myself seem cool.
Yeah,
you're scarred. Why was I doing that? You know what I mean? Yeah, who am I trying to impress?
Yeah.
Another fucking cell guy?
Yeah, you're in this, you're like, also don't want to get your ass kicked and be like all this. I mean, my brief time in jail, you would see all these guys trying to talk about.
Yeah. This one act bigger than you are and tougher than you
this
are.
This one guy, because I got arrested in central booking in Brooklyn, which is very, very, you know, a black, you know, jail. And there were maybe like four or five white guys. A couple of them were like these giant Irish guys with bow legs and scars like Michael Williams and The Wire down their face. Scary looking dudes. There's one guy, slacks, button down, glasses, a Jewish guy, a little bit chubby. And I'm thinking like, this guy's going to get fucked up. First, I was like, I'm going to get fucked up. But he's going to get fucked up first. Luckily, he's here.
Yeah, you're like, I'm tougher than that guy.
Yeah, they're gonna go, if anyone gets beat up, it's going to be him. Because I was there for like 28 hours. It was brutal.
And, yeah, but you seem like you can handle yourself a little bit. You're well, into martial arts.
This is before I was doing jiu-jitsu too at the time. So at the time, I had athleticism and energy, but I didn't know what the fuck to do. So I would have just been a spaz if anyone had tried to fight me.
Yeah.
So this guy was like, yeah, you know, I hit this guy in the fucking head with a bottle at the bar. And he was like talking all shit. I was like, oh, wow, I misread this guy.
Yeah.
And then when you go up for your, I guess, arraignment or whatever in front of the judge, and they kind of put you in this little bus shelter so you can't hear the other case, but I was right in the end. And this guy was like, okay, this is your third felony assault on a minor with a 13-year-old girl. So obviously this guy was a fucking pedo.
Ugh.
And he was trying to pretend that he was this tough guy who's beating up bartenders because he was like, if they find out I'm a pedo, I'm fucked.
Oh, yeah.
You know? So anyway, so how long were we in the precinct for? Was it like a longer interrogation room where you sat there at a table and good cop, bad cop comes in and all that shit?
Yeah, yeah. There was that afterwards, but I remember staying there for a couple days, but I got bailed out.
Yeah.
And
by who?
Through a bail bondsman.
Bail bondsman.
And then got an attorney through another friend of mine who was also a drug dealer who told me, you know, get this lawyer, Kay Sunday.
Yeah.
And she's great.
Yeah.
You know, she's actually a famous lawyer in San Diego.
Yeah.
Defense lawyer.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I got her and then
Money, where's the money coming from?
The money for
to get the lawyer.
I had money.
You had money.
I was a drug dealer.
But they didn't seize all your assets and freeze your bank accounts.
No.
Yeah, yeah. And your parents doing this. Were your parents doing? What were they saying? Your first phone call.
They didn't know, and I didn't tell them until they got a fucking letter from the courts.
Oh.
They sent it to my permanent address, which was their house. And honestly, going to jail, getting busted, the law school shit, finding out, being in the paper, was nothing compared to that phone call that I got from my parents.
Oh, man.
Saying how fucking disappointed.
Of course.
Like, we didn't raise you to be like this. You know, the whole time you were dealing drugs. And, you know, my heart was broken. Yeah, yeah, bro. I was just ashamed.
Yeah.
And I didn't even need to do it. They were giving me money. I had, you know, student loans. I had financial aid. I didn't need to sell drugs, bro.
Yeah. And at that time, you also didn't have the self-awareness maybe to realize that part of the reason you were doing that is because of this pressure and unhappiness and the stuff that you experienced growing up.
It was my outlet. It was my outlet to escape to find some sort of happiness.
Because you weren't doing therapy.
But I was going the wrong way with it. You know what I mean?
So you get busted and the court – how long is the court case from getting busted through court and on until it's resolved? How long does that take?
Man, it took probably 2 years.
Yeah,
a year and a half, 2 years.
God damn.
And that's the time when, you know, about a year into, you know, and I was sober and I had taken a bunch of.
When did you get sober in this process? Like right away?
I was sober, not right away. No, when I first got out, I fucking, you know, needed to smoke some weed. You know what I mean? Because I was stressed the fuck out.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But after that, I tried to stay sober. And get sober because I wanted to still get into the bar association.
Was you getting sober on your own accord, or did someone go like, "Dude, you need to do"? Like, was there like a deus ex machina?
Well, I got sober because I was on probation, and I still wanted to. Yeah, they tested you, but even then, I couldn't get sober for a while.
Yeah.
So,
What was the final thing that made you kind of go, I need to fucking do this now?
When I overdosed at a strip club while I was getting a lap dance.
Okay.
Yeah, the stripper jacked me of my pills, jacked me of my money, and I woke up in the hospital. I had soiled my pants, which is a euphemism for I shit my pants, and I had a tube down my throat, tube down my dick, and I woke up, and I didn't know where the fuck I was. So the doctor comes in, says, you almost died choking on your own puke, and he's seen many people die like that. But that wasn't the crazy part, Bill. The crazy part was 3 days later, I was out drinking and doing coke again.
Of course.
Because I was an addict.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So when I came down from that, I didn't want to face myself because I was fucking crazy. You know what I mean? And I didn't want to face the fact that I was suicidal, right? Who does that?
Yeah.
Who goes out after they overdosed?
Yeah.
People that want to die.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to die at that point. And
sure.
I was so miserable. And coming down from that high, I did the only thing that I could do. I curled up in a little ball, cried my eyes out, and said, God, please help me.
Have you prayed in a
life? I haven't prayed in a long time, brother. And God wasn't in my life because, you know, I was living a life opposite of what I was taught, right?
Yeah.
But even then, God was with me, you know,
yeah.
and protecting me and putting me on a different path,
yeah.
a much better path. And I didn't know that.
You didn't know that.
And so I'm not saying I had a spiritual experience or anything, but something shifted inside
something shifted,
of me
yeah.
where I became willing. I became willing to give my will and my life to a simple program, which has been around since the 1930s and saved millions of people.
Millions
and it's
people.
Called Alcoholics Anonymous.
Yeah. So when you got to, when you woke up from this fetal position, this cry, had you heard about AA? You knew AA. You're a smart guy. You knew AA was around.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know, how'd you go about finding how to get into it? Did you have a friend? Did you have anything that kind of like usher you into this program, or you just kind of, you did the work yourself? You found
it? Well, at first I went because, you know, there's little brochures and catalogs you look at that tells you all the meanings. There's over 3,000 meanings in L.A. Did
wow.
you know that?
Mm-mm.
Yeah, there's 3,000 meetings just in L.A.
Wow.
Any time of the day. So it's easy to find the meetings. You just have to have the desire to go.
Yeah.
Right? And at first, yeah, I just go because I have to go, and I want to get sober so I can become a lawyer. And
yeah.
I move into my parents' house again.
Just pragmatic. Wasn't spiritual, wasn't emotional, wasn't therapeutic.
Well, some of it was pragmatic.
Yeah.
And because I wanted to live.
Yeah.
You know, I knew I was going to die if I kept going. You know, because
yeah.
I was very, very bad at that point.
So when you got into AA for your first time, because I always think about like the first time you do anything that's transformative.
Actually, can you take the parts about the AA out? Because I'm not supposed to say it in the level of press, radio, and film. It's supposed to be anonymous.
I understand
yeah,
that,
yeah.
but is that still the case? Because
yeah.
I felt that idea
yeah,
had
I just,
been
when
sort
I said it, I was like, I shouldn't have said
okay.
that.
Okay.
I'll say a 12-step program.
Because I just feel like I remember that, whatever this 12-step program, but
mm-hmm.
I'd heard that idea, because of the stigma, has sort of been removed in the past.
I don't think it's about the stigma.
Yeah.
There's an old story about a famous baseball player that told everybody he got sober through this program,
uh-huh.
and then he relapsed. So it reflected on the whole program.
Interesting.
And so when you're, you know, a public figure and you're saying it on the level of press, radio, and film, then all of a sudden you relapse, then people throw away the baby with the bathwater and say, you know, the 12-step program doesn't work.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So that's why it's anonymity. People
okay.
think anonymity is like, oh, I don't want to tell, I don't have to tell anyone that I'm, that's not what anonymity is about.
Yeah.
When you find out what the 12 traditions are,
yeah.
and, you know, read about the level of press, radio, and film part,
yeah.
then you know the anonymity is more to protect the program.
The program.
Not
and,
you.
And keep
you know what I mean?
Integrity. Yeah, it makes sense. Because I'd always thought that particularly when I didn't realize it was the 30s. I thought it was the 50s. But I always thought that it was because alcoholism is such a weird, nebulous disease.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Mitch Hedberg has this great bit about it. He goes, alcoholism is the only disease people can get mad at you for having.
Yeah.
No one's like, God damn it, Bill, you have lupus, you know?
Yeah.
You're not alcoholic. So I feel that like it was always but you feel like in L.A., particularly in entertainment, not only is there not really shame attached to it, there's almost a deeper community attached to the idea of like, hey, man, you're artists, and this is what this makes sense. As a matter of fact, there's a long time, you know, friends of mine who were musicians and became famous, it was almost equivalent of like getting shot as a rap artist.
Yeah.
You were a rap artist in the 80s and no one shot you. You're like, who the fuck were you?
Yeah.
That's changed because rap and pop have sort of, been more conflated.
The rappers decided they wanted to live.
They wanted to live.
East Coast, West Coast beef was all bullshit.
Yeah, they're like, I'll do
it. I'd rather just make money. And live,
yeah.
right?
So it's completely different. But it used to be like,
same
out with rock stars, like if you didn't have some sort of drug addiction.
Yeah, and then when Tupac and Biggie died, they're like, actually, you can die over this shit.
Yeah,
so let's not try to make this credible, right? Yeah.
But I definitely feel like, as a matter of fact, in my life as a artist and as an actor and comic, I'm like, man, I've never had an addiction. It makes me feel like a loser. But because it does add it's such an interesting dynamic for people to overcome.
Yeah,
and it really speaks to a character and a level of commitment, because like you're committed to, like when I do jiu-jitsu, the people who come from a 12-step program in jiu-jitsu are beasts, because the level of focus they had on doing drugs and getting fucked up,
yeah,
they bring to the mat.
Yeah. And honestly, that's one of the reasons I'm successful
100%.
With comedy is I'm addicted.
Yeah.
You can't beat someone that's addicted to something.
Do you feel,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because I just do it because it's fucking compulsive.
You cannot do it.
Yeah.
Do you feel like that drug addicts, alcoholics in general, it's sort of like an extension of an OCD, like an obsessive compulsive disorder that just sort of this.
It is OCD. Yeah.
Yeah. It is,
yeah.
OCD.
Yeah. I get obsessed about shit.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And I do, you know.
Yeah. So what is, so after all this, so the lawyer got you off,
mm-hmm.
and you didn't have to go to prison or anything like that.
Well, I was on probation.
Ankle monitor or anything like that?
No. Nothing like that. And then, because they saw that
you're
was a law student that lost his way.
Yeah.
You know? So that's the story that we told, right?
Yeah.
And it was true. You know what I mean? But I wasn't done yet, you know? I wasn't done yet because I went to the Bar Association Character and Fitness Committee that determines, it's like a court of lawyers that decide whether or not you are fit to sit for the bar. And because of this felony, they said that I was not fit yet. You know, I mean, I could have kept going, you know, on that path and found and kept rehabilitating and then went back and, you know, you
like
go back
Morgan
every year
Freeman,
if you want,
Shawshank,
you know?
Redemption.
Like, am I ready now? You
yeah,
know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah.
So basically at that point I went in a tailspin when they said no, because I'd been working so hard, you know, studying for the bar, you know, getting signatures at these meetings, like pages and pages of signatures, letters from my pastor. I was going to church. I was praying. I thought I was doing everything right. Mm-hmm. And then why, God, are you going to, you know, deny this for me? You know,
they denied you once or twice or how many times?
They denied me twice, actually.
Twice, wow.
They denied me freaking twice. And so I was like so mad.
Yeah.
You know, I still had anger issues.
Of course.
I haven't dealt with that stuff yet.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it just came to the surface and I was so mad at the Bar Association. I was so mad at God. I was so mad at the cops and so mad at the people that gave me the drugs. You know what I mean? Everybody.
Yeah.
Right? My parents.
Yeah.
You know, for the abuse of childhood. All of it, right?
Yeah.
And I relapsed, bro. And yeah. I almost died again.
So how this relapse looked like? Was it like no, and then it presented itself in a way that was like,
yeah, man, I was just ready to say fuck it.
Where were you when this happened?
When I relapsed,
party or
I don't even remember, but it just was a decision that
it's just there.
You know,
like,
what?
Fuck it, here we go.
I'm gonna fucking escape.
And you OD'd again.
I didn't OD again, but I knew one of my girlfriends OD'd, and she almost lost her life and lost some of her fingers because her liver shut down.
Jesus
and
Christ.
And so she wasn't getting, you know,
yeah.
the toxins taken out.
Yeah.
And so she lost some of her fingers. And here's the crazy part. Just a few years ago, I went to Seattle. I won't say who she is.
Yeah.
But I went there and she wanted a fucking party still. She still wanted a party. So what does it take for an addict to stop? Like, we go through so much.
Yeah.
And we just chalk it up to, oh, it's just a bad night. You know, I won't do that. I won't do GHB and alcohol again.
Yeah.
That's all it was. I fucked up and combined the wrong shit. I just won't do Oxy again.
100%.
Or I just won't do fucking crack again.
Isn't that wild?
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But little do you know, every problem in your life, you can trace right back to drugs and alcohol. Like every problem in my life, my legal problems, my relationship problems, my relationship with my parents, not getting into the, you know, law school.
Yeah.
Every problem I had was because of drugs and alcohol.
For
but
sure.
I couldn't see it.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the denial part. And I have a friend right now, man. Like, he can't see it. His alcoholism is ruining his life. But he's got all the money in the world.
Yeah.
So he keeps on bailing himself out.
And if you have that money, you have a bunch of yes men. You're like, it's fine.
Yeah, yeah.
Here's what's interesting, because as someone who's been working 12-step programs and stuff like this, I find myself, like I said, I said, I've been drawn to people who have that. Maybe because I've never been that obsessive. I've always been, I don't want to say I'm beta, because it makes me sound like a cook. But I've always been pretty mellow. Like, I don't get, I get like obsessive enough, and then I'm like, okay, like, I'll like 4 spots a week is fine.
Yeah,
I don't need to do 14 spots a week.
Yeah,
just give me 3 or 4. I'm happy.
So you like to do just enough,
Like jujitsu, like I'm getting my black belt now, but like And
well,
now
that's
I have to, pretty impressive.
Kind
of, it's been a long time.
Oh,
do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So
you took the long track.
But I'm kind of going, oh shit, I got to like step up my game to pass my test and stuff. So I have that energy, but I'm really drawn to people who have that. But the thing is, so when I have these friends, like I had a friend exactly who was, he OD'd, he almost died. He was found by his stepmom, brought to the hospital, whole thing. And pills and alcohol, you know, I feel like pills and alcohol are like the combination that is sort of like the unspoken thing that happens the most.
Yeah.
Is pills and alcohol combined. So OD, got sober.
Well, these days it's even more dangerous.
Yes,
because
of course,
shit's cut fentanyl. With fentanyl.
Yeah.
Like I know people that had no intention of doing fentanyl.
Of course.
And they got poisoned with pills that they were just trying to do some Vicodin.
It wasn't like snorting shit.
They're trying to
like
do
pills.
Some cocaine. The infamous case of, you know,
yeah,
KQ and,
yeah.
and all those people.
Bananas,
right?
Yeah. And so
like
happened.
They weren't trying to do fentanyl.
Of course not. Yeah. So that he is like, and I'm like, hey man, I care about you. You're a brilliant writer. You're this guy. You're like, you're my little brother. I want to help you. Da, da, da. Don't fucking do this shit, man. Come on. And, you know, and then he starts drinking again.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, I can't be that guy who's like, you can't drink. Because when I'm like, hey, are you good? He's like, well, I'm just drinking, man. It's not pills. It was the pills and the drinking, you know. But I just almost can predict it's going to happen again.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Of course it will.
Yeah.
And
I don't know what to fucking do about it. Because what do? You can't stop him from drinking.
Yeah.
And then when he drinks and when it happens again, then you'd be like, oh, I should have done something.
Yeah.
It's a weird thing to be on the other side of it, you know?
Yeah, no, I've been on the other side of it as well.
Yeah.
I've lost many friends
to
drugs and alcohol. Many,
wow.
many friends.
Yeah.
And there's nothing you can do. I mean, you can tell them you're available to go to meetings.
Yeah.
You can tell them that there's a better way. I'm helping about four friends right now.
So
in one day, like three people reached out to me.
Oh, wow.
You know? I don't know. I think they see that my life's getting better.
Yeah.
And that I've been sober for over 8 years now. And they see all my success and they're like, man, I want what you have.
Are these right? Sort of like sponsees or not official?
They're not sponsees yet, but they could be. But it's just friends in my life that, you know, I've been an open door for them to come talk to about drugs and alcohol. And I get it. And they say only another alcoholic can help another alcoholic because we know exactly what you're going through.
Exactly.
Everyone else is like, why don't you just fucking stop?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Why are you doing this again?
Yeah.
They don't get it.
It's,
you know what
like
I mean?
A non-mom telling a mom how to raise a kid. You're
yeah.
What the fuck?
Well, you first share your story
and
you show the powerlessness of it and you show the unmanageability of your life before you got sober. And then they're like, man, maybe they get it, you know, because that's how I feel.
So
right?
you're the first time you shared in your 12-step was your do you like remember transformative moments? Like I imagine the first share would be always nerve wracking and just tough to do and exposing yourself in such a way. I guess it feels very safe in these programs, but like, do you remember that? Do you have moments where you were sharing any epiphanies or anything that you kind of just like, where things just kind of popped in your brain? Where you're like, man, this is what it's all about.
Well, I always loved talking. And I loved sharing.
Yeah.
And it was some of my first comedy bits.
Of course.
In the meetings.
Of course.
Because I would love to make people laugh.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's where I learned to be vulnerable, too.
Yeah.
So I could talk about some of this stuff also in my comedy.
Yeah.
And so it's a real, you know, doing both has helped my, you know, help the other and help the other.
Yeah.
Because each of them is about talking and being vulnerable. And exposing yourself, right?
Yeah. Yeah. That's very cool.
Yeah.
So now you get out, you after 2 years you beat the charge. You still have a felony in your record, you can't get in the bar, you relapse again, you get back in the, you know, programs trying to help yourself. Now where does comedy start to come? It comes out of sharing, comes out of this talking.
Those were my first comedy bits was in the meetings.
Do you remember them? Do you remember some of the first like things that you kind of...
Yeah, I would make people laugh just telling my stripper story about ODing in a strip club while I was getting a lap dance. And
I
get a laugh.
Yeah, yeah.
The stripper jacked me of my pills, jacked me of my... You know, I already had...
And didn't jack you off.
It was like you know what I mean? Yeah, exactly. It was like you know, it was already scripted.
Yeah,
you know what
I
mean? This is what I'm going to say when I tell this part of my story.
Oh, wow.
And then with getting those laughs, okay, I'm going to say it like that again.
But how
right?
right? How did comedy present itself to you in terms of an opportunity to go up and say, was it something like, hey, you should go do, because for me it was
Told all my life. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh yeah, it was like this guy, a friend of mine from college was doing stand-up in New York and talking about, I was like, huh, and I was never much of a, I was never a good speaker. I mean, you know, in some programs and therapy, it's like you learn that, you know, the thing that your biggest mantra becomes the thing that you need to prove, right? So my thing of people thinking that I was dumb or white trash because of the way I talk, because I had a lisp and I had like vocal constriction and vocal problems. And,
oh, wow. I didn't know that.
And, yeah, all this shit. I couldn't make myself heard. I become an actor and a comic. I mean, how it's beyond ironic, but it's not ironic because that is the mantra is like, no, listen to me. I have thoughts. Mm-hmm. Don't shut me down because I have a small voice and a lisp. So, for me, I was like, oh, comedy is not my forte because I'm not really a speaker. I was a dancer. I was a go-go dancer and a break dancer and shit. So I was like, but my friend was doing, I had this weird kind of idea about it. He basically was like, look, man, just get drunk. I'll pay for the open mic. Just come down and do it. You're funny. And I bombed my first time, which made me realize two things. One, bombing isn't so bad. And also, I don't want to bomb again. So then I kind of like started working on my act, which just started all physical. And eventually I was able to kind of like become a more adept at speaking and formulating my thoughts and my language. But so for you, was it again like on your own? You went to an open mic and you found it? Or was there someone's like, bro, let me come here? Like how active were you in pursuing the comedy the first time? I was drag kicking and screaming as well.
Somehow I ended up three blocks away from the Tacoma Comedy Club in Tacoma,
Great
Washington.
Comedy club, by the way.
Yeah.
I'll be there in a month.
And I was just drive by that place. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And actually it was called Comedy Underground back then.
Okay.
It was Comedy Underground. Now it's Tacoma Comedy Club in a different area, actually. So it's Comedy Underground, which no longer exists. But I would drive by there. And this is like, you know, 18 years ago.
Yeah.
Okay. Because I've been doing comedy now for almost 18 years.
Wow.
And I would drive by the place and, you know, I always wanted to do it, you know. And then my friend invited me to the open mic there one night. And then I watched him do it. And then I was like, I want to try this.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I think I could do this. And so the next week, you know, wrote down all my jokes that I ever had, you know, ever told at a party at 3 minutes, went up there, blacked out, said a bunch of shit, don't even know, got some laughs, I know that, but I remember the way I felt.
And you were sober.
I was sober.
Yeah.
And so I felt it all.
Yeah.
And
right away, you're like,
man, this is
where it is.
The biggest dopamine rush I've gotten since cocaine.
Wow.
You know, and I couldn't even sleep that night. It's so such a dopamine rush, right?
Yeah,
this is some heady stuff, right? When you're getting up there and getting laughs.
Yeah.
And I still feel that way when I do certain shows, like something new and, you know, or new sort of platform.
Isn't that bizarre? I just did a show last night and I remember I followed Leslie Jones, who did 40 minutes at the Long Beach Laugh Factory. She's just when you're on the Leslie Jones fucking train, you're on the train. They just were there for her. They loved her. I'm like, my cracker ass has to follow Leslie Jones after doing 40 minutes for a show an hour late. I'm like, man.
How'd you do?
You did okay.
Really?
You know, well, you know, it's like, I mean.
Because I feel like you'd be conducive to the Leslie Jones crowd.
Yeah. Well, you know, how sometimes you're like, oh, I should have done this. Her stuff is so sexual. I should have just done all my sex jokes and just been fun with it. But I was like, I wanted to. I did like race stuff and COVID. I was like, okay, maybe not the way to go. But it was fine. It was fine. But it was like I was working. But the feeling beforehand of like getting up there, the kind of like the agita and the feeling of like, how is this going to go? It's bizarre that after, because for me it's 16 years now, that still happens. That you still have this feeling of like, what's going to happen now?
Yeah.
It's not like you're a cover band, you know, playing at Margaritaville. Like, you know, this is going to be fine.
Yeah.
There's always a feeling of like, this could go terribly wrong.
Oh, yeah.
Which is exciting.
Yeah.
Right?
And if it wasn't, then it wouldn't be exciting anymore, right?
100%.
Like if we knew exactly what was going to fucking happen.
Yeah. So you were addicted right away. You're like, this is what I want to do.
Yes. And so I just, you know, again, just became alcoholic about doing stand up.
Showed up every day,
every night. I want to do this, writing jokes, fucking doing, getting 5 minutes, you know, getting 10 minutes. Within my first year, I was already in my management company that sent me on tour as an opener. You know,
for
this
who?
Is
who'd
my
you
first
for?
Second. Different comedians, but they would, you know, send me out on the road.
That's wild for the first year.
Yeah, Portland Night and Day. And
who's your first headliner that you kind of connected to and worked with?
I don't even remember, bro. Honestly, I know it's one of the guys from Full House. Not Bob
Dave Coulier?
Saget. Yeah. Dave Coulier was one.
I mean, he was a big comic.
Yeah, he was a big comic.
Yeah,
he was cool.
Yeah.
But he wasn't like A-list comic.
No,
he was doing B rooms.
Solid B
comic for sure.
And you're going on the road. We first go on the road. That's just incredible, right? The feeling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, I kind of screwed that up though because they asked me if I could do 30 minutes.
And one time, of course.
And I said, I could do 30 minutes because I had a solid 10.
Yeah.
So why not?
Right.
I'll just do crowd play.
Yeah.
Go to this place. You know, the host brings me up. I'm supposed to do 30 minutes, and then, you know, the headline is supposed to do 50 minutes. And I go fucking probably about 10 minutes and then about 2 minutes of crowd play, and I'm just nothing. And the crowd's not giving me anything. You know those times when you're going out. So what do you guys do? Oh, I'm a banker? Oh, okay. Yeah. Nothing there. You know, how about you guys? You guys dating? Gene, and I'm just too new.
Yeah.
To be, you know, anywhere near doing that kind of fucking crowd play for fucking 15 minutes, right? So I just leave the fucking stage because I just didn't have anything to say.
You're like, good night, guys. You walk up.
And the fucking host is outside smoking.
Of course.
And I'm like trying to find the host. Hurry up. And there's just a silent, dead silence for like fucking 5 minutes up there. And of course, I get a call from my manager like, we're not booking you no more because you think I got a really bad report. I got some bad notes from you. And I knew what it was.
Yeah. And so they dropped you?
They dropped me. Yeah. She dropped me because I lied. I lied and also ruined that show kind of.
But also, look, we're the same plant, right? We're going to lie.
Yeah. Yeah,
you have an hour clean, Bill?
Yeah.
Of course I have an hour clean.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we all lie to get to where you're at. But I learned my lesson that you shouldn't lie.
Yeah.
Because you get it, you know, in too deep and you can lose out on the opportunities.
Yeah, of course.
And I'm glad I learned it in Seattle instead of here.
Yeah.
So now, you know, when I came here, I've had all those mistakes that I've already made as a green pea. And
when'd you get
I
here?
Don't have to make it again.
When'd you come to LA?
It's been 15 years now.
15 years.
Yeah.
And so did you have connections in LA when you got here?
I knew nobody.
Nobody.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just soldier.
I knew nobody.
Now, during this whole process, are your parents...
But I am living in a sober living.
You're living in sober living.
Yeah.
I can't tell you how many women I've dated who were living in sober living while we started.
Yeah, it helps. And then you have immediate friends and you go to meetings together. And because I was scared of L.A. You know? But I ended up relapsing even in L.A.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, you're not done till you're done. And each time relapse, hopefully you learn something if you have the privilege
of
making it back.
Yeah, that's the idea.
You
know, I know that friends of mine who've been relapsed, they say, you know, there's this feeling of failure when they relapse. But then, you know, the idea is that each time you relapse, you're a little bit closer to where you actually need to be completely sober. You know? So when you relapsed in L.A., you were doing comedy. You're on your path, on your mission, doing what you love. What was the triggering factor that made you kind of go, here we go. It's there. It's there in front of me. Give it here.
I think I just got bored. You know, and I felt like I was stagnant in my career.
Sure.
I was stagnant in my life, and I felt like I was never going to make it. And it just seems so daunting getting up this mountain, you know, that is stand-up comedy in L.A.
Crazy,
you know,
right?
I feel like weren't letting me in. I felt like I wasn't far enough. I was comparing and contrasting to other people. Why is everybody else fucking making it?
Yeah.
Chris D'Elia already has a fucking sitcom.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, why is this happening?
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm actually now grateful that I didn't have the kind of success that Chris D'Elia has had because, you know, it comes with its pitfalls, right?
Oh,
you get under this microscope
and
you get into these troubling situations that you know, at the time I was jealous of. You know, he'd be with a different chick every fucking week at the comedy store.
Yeah.
And I'm like, how come he's getting all the success and he's on a show?
Yeah.
And I'm fucking still doing the open mics and fucking trying to get on the fucking, comedy store open mics, you know, the potlucks.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And he's already got his own show and he's headlining?
Yeah.
You know? Like, so, you know, when you compare and contrast, man, you feel
always.
Like shit.
It's always a better
right?
Yeah.
There's always someone
it's
ahead of you.
Not to,
and there's someone behind you.
Yeah.
But I ended up relapsing because I was just unhappy in my life again, you know? Like, that's what causes it. If you're irritable and discontent, you're going to relapse.
Yeah.
So it's very important to keep your mental health going and make sure that you're not quote unquote bored in your life and you're growing.
So what would you say if you were to give a checklist to somebody about whether it's drugs or alcohol or just depression or anything like that or just bad habits, a checklist of like, this is what I would like to give to someone. I'll be completely frank, like my daughter who just graduated Berkeley, you know, she deals with depression sometimes. And she's an amazing girl. I love her to death. But I sometimes I'm trying to find out a way to help her kind of navigate the situations.
Yeah.
And I give her like military checklists that like they say the military, like, do you have clean socks and underwear? Have you slept? Have you been drinking water?
Yeah.
Have you been eating? Like these very simple things that actually you kind of go, this is so dumb. They're like, actually, no, I haven't.
Yeah.
I haven't done this. So do you have a checklist for yourself or for people that you talk to when they're feeling that this feeling of boredom or things that you recommend?
One thing is a quick fix for me is I take a walk.
Yeah.
You know, you get outside, get some fresh air, get some sunshine, take a
vitamin
fucking
D,
walk, man.
Yeah.
You know, that alone will take care of maybe 30-40% of your depression.
Wow.
And then for me, meditation has been huge. I do transcendental meditation.
Oh, wow.
I do 20 minutes during the day, morning, and then I do 20 minutes at night. And I haven't missed a day in maybe almost 4 years.
How long?
4 years, yeah.
Wow, that's amazing.
And I do it every day. I'm going to go home and do it right now.
So much about, I mean, Howard Stern is a huge proponent.
It's changed my life, bro.
Yeah.
It took me to the next level of life.
Wow.
Yeah, it made me make a living doing stand up.
And if you think you know? About it, it's so easy to give yourself that much time to do anything.
Yeah.
I take 20 minutes of shit sometimes.
Yeah.
So the fact that it's available to people and they still don't do it,
I think a lot of people just don't know how to do it.
I'm dying to know how to
do
it.
People don't know how and they think they're doing it wrong. And they stop before the miracle happens, which can take, you know, it's not something that you meditate one day and all of a sudden you manifested your dreams and goals. You know what I mean? It's a matter of, you know, it starts just slowly chipping away at your trauma to where it actually heals your trauma.
Wow.
And believe it or not, depression and addictions, they all stem from trauma.
Of course.
You know, we all have trauma in this life, whether it was from your parents, from your childhood, shit that happened at school. We all carry around our own little trauma.
Even birth, you know.
Or even big traumas, right? So we carry that stuff around and we don't have any source of healing. You know, we just take pills.
Yeah.
And we take, you know, medicine instead of taking a walk instead of talking to a therapist meditating.
I don't know if you've heard this, but like there's a lot of these studies that just came out. And it's very weird because, you know, I've always been very liberal. I'm a card-carrying Democrat. But a lot of these studies come out that sort of are reinforcing a lot of things that people who are not so liberal have been saying. You know, a lot of studies came out about psychotropic drugs. Basically, like they don't really help. They're solving the symptoms but not the problem, right? So you want to get someone to cure of this, that, depression, anything else. Like, the pills aren't going to be the answer. The pills will solve the problem for a while, rarely permanently, but you got to get to the root of what's causing that.
Yeah.
And they've done studies that show that, like, the amount of, like, suicides and suicidal ideation with the psychotropic, but without, it doesn't change, right?
Yeah.
So it doesn't really help, you know? So I think about that a lot.
Well, it can actually cause the disorder in which you're taking it for.
Yeah.
For instance, if you take Ambien, You will actually be an insomniac if you get off
100%.
Of it. If you take Xanax, when you're off Xanax, you're going to be 10 times more anxious 100%. Than you were when you started the Xanax.
Yeah.
So it's actually causing the disorder or making it worse.
Yeah, exactly. Just by covering it up.
Yeah.
So you do the transition. I mean, that's amazing. So how'd you get into that? Did someone like bring you along?
Actually, just like 4 years ago, I woke up one day because I had a bunch of shows that I was producing on top of performing in them. And it was very high stress, man. It is high stress. You know, it isn't like hard work, like digging ditches for 8 hours, but the work that you do is very, very pressure cooker, you know,
and
you got to perform.
The crazy comics that are hitting you up.
Yeah, all the comics and all this shit. Yeah, it all adds up, right?
What the fuck, Jimmy?
I thought we were friends, right? Yeah. So, yeah, what ends up happening is you don't even know that you have all this stress and you're actually addicted to the cortisol, which is another chemical in your brain.
A
that you can
hormone,
get addicted to, just like adrenaline.
Interesting.
Long story short, I was so stressed out, I woke up one morning and half my face was paralyzed.
Bell's palsy?
It was Bell's palsy.
Wow.
And it's a stress disorder, a neurological thing right here. And I ended up doing some research. And, basically my doctor told me, you got to find a way to relax. And, you know.
I got too many shows. Yeah,
and
I'm
during
gonna
that
relax.
Time, of course, when you start living consciously, serendipity starts happening, right? Mm-hmm. Synchronicities. At that time, my friend Greg Baldwin, he goes, you want to go check out this transcendental meditation thing? And I'm like, yeah, man. I've been doing these YouTube meditations, but I'm willing to try something else. Go there, and everything just made sense.
Wow.
And it was like, I don't know. I just was a meditator or something in a previous life because
it just clicked.
It just worked, for me.
Yeah.
You know, for some people, it doesn't work right away and they have to try a little harder. But for me, I loved it.
Yeah.
Because it was just this. It was Jerry Seinfeld calls TM. It's like having a charger for your brain.
Wow. I love that.
And he's one of the most successful people ever.
And
right?
Howard Stern as
well. Yeah. So these are the top tier in every craft.
David Lynch.
You know, swearing by this stuff.
Yeah.
It might work.
Yeah.
You know
what
I mean?
Exactly.
It might work for me.
Yeah.
And so I try it and I, like I said, I start feeling less anxious. I don't need pills. I don't need anything. I don't, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I just feel good, man.
Yeah.
Just being, and I don't have to have all the shit and be super successful in the world's eyes for me to be happy.
100%. Yeah. I think we should leave it on that, man. That's really amazing. Jimmy, you're super cool, interesting, complicated. Dude, man, it's so good to get to know your story a little bit more. I'd love to, talk to you forever, but I'm sure you got 8 million shows you got to book and produce and be on right now. So where can people find you and follow you and all that stuff?
Yeah, they can find